Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 27th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Bill Hutchison. Today's session number is HUB 2001-04 and is titled, How Do We Deal With Mistakes? Let's listen in.
Use woodworking as a kind of analogous metaphor for talking about ministry. Sometimes people look at ministry as a kind of amorphous, intangible, hard to kind of get your hands around kind of area of work or endeavor. And woodworking obviously is very tangible, very hands-on, very concrete, and much more bounded, not so amorphous or vague. And so I also happen to be a pastor in Chicago, as well as on the side, what I call an avocation is woodworking. And I do processional crosses and altars and pulpits and things like that. And I've done quite a number of things for the ELCA. They have a churchwide assembly every 2 years, and they need a traveling roadshow of liturgical furniture that they use, because that way they know what they've got at each ballroom that they go to have the 1,200 some people that show up for those things be able to worship. And so, for me personally, it's an interest of mine of how do we put together woodworking and ministry? And please, when you see woodworking, you need to understand that that's not just, you know, high-end cabinet-making woodworking. That's rough carpentry, it's finished carpentry, it could be music, it could be sculpting, it could be throwing pots. Whatever is your realm. So please don't understand woodworking as this is a prescriptive thing. You've got to go out there and do woodworking. I'm always happy to promote woodworking, but see it as woodworking as a category of tangible stuff that we do with our hands. And ministry, by the same token, is not just ministry of pastors. I really take seriously the Lutheran understanding of priesthood of all believers, with our entering ministry as Christian disciples through our baptism. And so when I say ministry here, I'm really talking about a broad category that happens in many different settings. And in my particular case, it's in a congregational setting. In some of our, my sisters and brothers in Christ, it's in a work setting as a minister who has to deal with human resources, or who has to deal with time-bound projects, or has to deal with the cooperative project of one sort or another, or teaching, or researching, or all sorts of possibilities. So I'm talking about two broad categories, one that's very tangible, and you can translate into your experience of what that tangible thing is, and one that's not quite as tangible, but that we are all involved in as soon as we're baptized. So having said all of that, today we talk about how do we deal with mistakes in our work, because mistakes are not good, especially if we are physicians, especially if we are pastors, especially if we are, I'm Bill, by the way. What's your
name?
I'm
Bill. My name's Bella Tony.
Okay. And what's your work?
I'm a financial advisor. I work for Eastern Outlook.
And mistakes in financial advising are not good things, right?
Nope.
Because there are many zeros or implications when something doesn't quite work out the way it was intended, and you have to answer for it. We have a professor, pastor back here, Michael, and what is your work?
I'm a retired environmental engineer with a paper company.
Okay, and mistakes are not good in that setting either.
Not at all.
Because EPA is good at trying to help
us, yes. We're here to help you.
At least that's the line, right? And how about you, Sonny?
I'm an order rep for a catalog company.
Okay, and mistakes are definitely not cool there, because it's usually repetitive shipments and customers that maybe are taking off.
Angry another. Customers.
Yes, okay. So we all recognize that mistakes are not good and not to be encouraged, but we also, I think, are human enough to realize that inevitably mistakes occur. And yesterday I was talking about, not yesterday, I keep saying yesterday, Wednesday, in talking about how do we pace ourselves, Now, the subject of perfection in our work came up. And I mentioned how Oriental and Middle Eastern rug makers often deliberately put in a flaw somewhere in the manufacturing of their carpet, just so that they cannot be fooling themselves into thinking that they are aspiring toward perfection. And I said to myself, and shared with the group, that I think there's something very psychologically soothing about that, that I cannot bring myself at this point to introduce a mistake or a blemish into my woodworking intentionally. And I also went on to say that no matter how hard I try, inevitably a blemish or a mistake appears. Welcome. And Jean, what is your work? We're talking about our various works here.
I'm a hospital chaplain in a two location hospital. I have half of one of the hospitals.
Okay. We have a financial advisor back here. We have a oncologist. You do research as well, right?
Yeah, research, teach, and do surgery.
Right. And a professor, pastor back there, a former environmental
engineer.
And continues to work with the catalog order rep. And we were talking about how mistakes are not good in any of those settings. But we also know that mistakes are inevitable. So how do we deal with them? It's not a question of, I should back up. Part of it is a question of how to prevent them, but also recognizing that mistakes will happen. So what do we do with them when they occur? And obviously prevention, there's all sorts of training, there's all sorts of steps. And let's think about, just in the woodworking realm, and again, thinking about that as artistry or tangible endeavor, how do we try to deal with mistakes by prevention? What are some things that help us prevent mistakes?
Measure twice, cut once.
That's a good one. I think I've heard that once before. How about some others?
I think coming clean on the fact that you've done it and admitting to it, it makes you.
So that would be once a mistake has already happened.
It's not prevention.
And I'm going to call it.
It is prevention because you don't want to do that again. And that worked best in our environment.
So from previous mistakes, you come clean, as you put it, but then that can kind of come back to cycle around as a prevention because you acknowledged it, you've learned from it, and now you see it as a priority to prevent that from happening again. Okay.
As my father always used to say, think.
Think.
That kind of biblical concept of, you know, count the costs before you do something and, you know, what this is going to cost you to do, whether it's monetarily or time or talents.
Okay, consider or count the costs. Any other thoughts?
Big organizations like ours, it's, you know, this total quality management changes names every couple of years, but basically you're measuring what you've done before, and then you're figuring out ways to, you know, plan small pilot projects, and, you know, so if you're always getting bad lumber from the same lumber yard, you measure, say I've got, you know, the last 9 projects I did, 4 of them were bad, and they all came from the same source. So you figure out where your problems are, and just by measuring infection rates or complications, a lot of times they'll disappear. The numbers will go down. Just a matter of being aware.
So it's taking this feedback loop and making it more intentional and tightening up the timing so that rather than waiting for 3 years to go by or 30 patients to die, you might say, oh, we've already had two patients die from similar causes within a 3-month period, both on the same ward with similar presenting things. Is there some personnel issue here? Is there some kind of nosocomial infection or whatever? And it's also trying to create that learning curve coming around more quickly so that you stay on target. What I'm trying to draw there, not very effectively, is a spiral. So that, you know, if you have a set of crosshairs and you're trying to stay on target, you're going to deviate a little bit here, but you're still making progress and you kind of go a little bit forward. Now you're over here a little bit, but you're basically staying kind of centered on that target, and it's spiraling. Some people think of spiraling as being out of control, but I'm trying to say that you can take your spiraling and use it to sort of stay in that central area right around the crosshairs. Let's talk a little bit about handling mistakes, and I came up with a little bit of a list of what kinds of mistakes one could come up with in woodworking, and you can think about other artistries as well. You cut a piece too short, we already alluded to that. You cut the joint or the angle badly or incorrectly, and sometimes half a degree is just enough to make it a really bad joint that won't glue well. You chip off a piece of wood in the handling of the wood in the shop. You are turning around to another tool and you smack the face of the board up against the metal saw and you say, oh, and that was right where it was going to have the face of the cross or something. You gouge the face of the wood. Just in the handling with tools, you might make a mark on the face of the wood. But the tool slips and leaves a mark, and that's another note or reminder that sharper tools are better because you don't have to put as much force to overcompensate for the dull edge, not doing so much effective cutting of the wood. Too much glue. That inevitably squeezes out from the joints, and then you've got all this cleanup to do. And if you're not quick about it, it soaks into the wood, which then means that the stain doesn't take as evenly where that glue is caught in the grain of the wood. The whole thing is not squared. Now, on some pieces, that's not that critical, but on some, it means that the thing's going to wobble if it's a four-legged object, or it means that you've got it looking great, but from this one angle, you can clearly see that the whole thing is canted, and so instead of having rectangles, you've got parallelogram for size of your altar or whatever. Or it's maybe just not even. Not even in the sense of the symmetry, if you're trying to achieve that, or maybe the finish isn't even across the face of the wood, or maybe the routing of an edge, you see little burn marks and it's just not even as you go along. And bad finishing techniques, and that's a whole other realm. Suppose you've built this thing and it's nice, you've somehow managed not to ding the wood along the way, and now you're doing finishing. And sometimes if you don't allow enough time, you tend to rush things, and that leads to unevenness on the staining, or if you're just clear coating it, you can get runs where you're trying to put it on too thickly, or you're not allowing enough drying time so between coats. So then you go on with a second or third coat, and it starts to build up in certain areas. Sometimes it's bad staining, or not thoroughly stirred. If you're, this is actually something that I've learned the hard way. Glossy clear coats are actually easier to work with than the satin or the semi-gloss. And the reason is the gloss has no particulate matter in the finish. But the satins and the semi-glosses, there's actually, I don't really know what the substrate is, but it's something that tends to settle out. And when you first open the can, you have to be sure to stir up this stuff, much like you have to do paint with pigment. And it's almost a kind of translucent pigment that cuts the sheen when the stuff levels out, so that you don't get that brilliant reflective shine like a glossy coat, which has none of this particular material. And so if you forget to stir as you're going along, you might be taking a half an hour to 45 minutes to an hour to coat this piece. Well, clearly in that time, this particulate matter is going to settle out. So if you don't remember every 10 minutes or so to stir it up again to keep the particulate matter up where you're dripping your brush, you're going to get sheens that don't match across the piece, and you'll get shiny areas, and you'll get more of a satin finish. Inferior wood selection, that's kind of even before all the rest of this, if you just didn't pick very good wood. I had this happen. I was a small part of my own personal life. I graduated from college. Christy was graduating a year later, so I had this in-between year. And I wish I had known about Lutheran Volunteer Corps, but I didn't at the time. I ended up hodgepodging together a year of jobs to kind of occupy myself. And one of them was working in a prison as a corrections officer. And I got so bored toward the end of that that I started doing woodworking projects that I could be designing while I was in block patrol and drawing things out. And at that point, I couldn't afford very expensive woods, and so I looked around my dad's workshop and said, okay, what can I make out of these scraps of plywood? And I remember spending probably 2 weeks while at prison trying to maximize the space of a record cabinet, stereo record cabinet, out of this one sheet of plywood plus a few other scraps that were around the shop. And when I got it all done, it turned out so nice that I wished I had, you know, spent more on the wood and gotten birch plywood or something a little more exotic rather than just regular old plywood. And to this day, I still have this thing, but it's still inferior wood. So the point I'm trying to make is, if you really put yourself into something, make sure it's good material. Mm-hmm. And you can think about that with sewing, you can think about that with, you know, the clay, the quality of the clay you're using, if it was the sculpture, or music, if you're gonna, you know, really spend the time on it, make sure you write it down or get some kind of recording or something so that you have something when it's all done that's of substance. I'm going to translate over now into ministry and sort of think about some of these things that we've just talked about, the kinds of mistakes that come up in our hands-on kinds of things. And what are some mistakes that come up in ministry? And by this, again, I mean a very broad understanding. Thinking as the financial advisor, thinking as the physician, thinking as the environmental engineer, as the order, Hemlock Order representative, as the professor, as the chaplain. What are some mistakes that have arisen in your work? Misdiagnosis.
Well, yeah, I've heard that happens.
I don't want to speak for you, but I'm just thinking why.
Sure.
What's another kind of mistake?
Incorrect address.
Wrong address. That makes a huge difference.
Getting a professional relationship off on the wrong foot.
Okay.
Thinking somebody has a sense of humor when they don't.
Well, the other way around. They do and you don't.
Set a wrong goal, such as they want to double their money overnight.
That's a good one. Setting wrong goals. I want to come back to that one when we keep talking here. Anything else?
Too much. I like the too much bleeding. If you right, if you work so hard to try to make a relationship work or a group gel, or I was thinking in terms of teaching, you work so hard to make something stick in their mind, and maybe it just won't, and maybe you've engaged in a kind of overkill. I think about the too much glue is kind of an overkill response to a situation.
Trying to be helpful, trying to be enabling, trying to be that person that kind of holds the situation together. I imagine that has never happened in chaplaincy work.
And misinterpreting, along with that, you know, misinterpreting someone's needs and thinking you understand it when you've missed the mark.
Well, something that goes with your the woodworking and this is, you know, finding you don't have the resources you thought you had, or you go to open the box and find that someone else eat the last of the Cheerios.
I'm going to put inadequate resources or, in quotes, wrong resources. Mm-hmm. Meaning they might be adequate, but not for this situation, and it's not a good fit. Ideas I thought of thinking about the woodworking again, but in the ministry category, cutting corners. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can think of that in so many mm-hmm. realms. Working too fast, rushing things, trying to do too much at once. And you could translate that in almost all of our, you know, taking processing too many orders simultaneously or in one batch, or trying to treat too many patients in one chunk of time, or trying to have too many family in need that you're ministering to, where you're just not trying to say that you're not able to do it, but for the long haul to try and too many families at once, it burns you. Too many irons in the fire on one month's time can lead to confusion between accounts and clients and so forth. And Michael, you never try and do too much, do you?
No.
Tactlessness. And that fits a little bit with what we were talking about, bad start to work relationships. It might have involved a tactless comment, but it might mean even when you do have good working relationships that there are times where we can be less than tactful in our approach. Pushing at the wrong time. You know, we all have to push ourselves, and we also have to push certain things that we think are the right way to go at various times, but sometimes we push at the wrong time. And you can almost imagine woodwork where you're pushing it at the wrong time through the tool, or you're pushing to get something done with a deadline, and I've had this happen, true confessions, where I've got a deadline with the ELCA where they have to have the credence table and the shipping crate by such and such a date because the semi-tractor trailer is literally going to be pulling out of the ELCA archives at such and such a day, such and such a time. And I've never missed a deadline yet, but let's just say I've pushed the envelope of how close one can come to a deadline. I've not yet seen the tractor trailer pull up, but I've come within an hour of seeing the tractor trailer pull up and open its doors and ready to load things on, and that's just a little bit too close. too solicitous. And, you know, that is something where I think someone was trying to say it, or did say it. When we were talking about too much glue, just trying too hard to win folks over in the situation.
See, when you said too much glue, I was thinking it's more like, you know, trying to fix a mistake, you know, the backward way, but if you've got too much space in the joint, instead of recutting it, just
throw a little more glue.
It'll work.
It can be either way, trying to cover up a mistake or just push a little bit harder. You sort of feel like in your gut you're not necessarily on the right track, but it's still your training or your orientation has been to do it this in such a way in these sort of situations. And so if I just push a little bit harder, just throw a little bit more of the same old, maybe it'll, you know, finally stick. It'll finally carry the situation. I don't know any pastors like that.
That's what an expert is. You know how you can cut the corner or take the shortcut in a way that will still turn out the way that you would have.
Right.
Yeah, I'd like to add, I mean, in terms of some of these things, I'm not going to stick with the glue thing, but it works with others, that there's sometimes a sense of, you know, mistrust. trust of the others you're working with or the materials you're working with. Like, you know, we all know what the appropriate amount of glue might be. Well, you know, sometimes, well, it can happen with all sorts of other things, but you go, oh, well, that little bit of glue isn't going to hold this joint together, so to be safe, I'm going to, you know, double it, you know, what do you do with it? Or, you know, that kind of thing that, you know, a task is going on in the congregation or something. Well, I'm not sure that the folks on this committee can handle that, so I better inject myself in there a little more, and you kind of end up making a mess of it, or you do make a mess of it, because right away it's interpreted as, well, don't you trust it? You know, we can handle this. You're not the only one who can do ministry around here or can do this.
This is becomes arrogance.
Yeah,
and my feels a lot of arrogance too. You're too arrogant to even recognize your mistakes. Figure it's almost somebody else's fault.
Or as Tillich would call it, hubris, where we, in a sense, set ourselves up as all-knowing in this instance, and our own pride gets in the way of seeing that maybe other angles or other expertise or stepping back would be even better. This is a sort of slight tangent, but this idea of mistrusting of others and thinking of charism and charisma and charismatic leaders, where often they will be very effective, especially in church circles, it seems like they'll be very effective in building up a chaplaincy or a congregation or some ministry setting that's maybe related with a social service agency or something like that. And if we think classically about where the word charismatic comes from, it comes from charism, which has to do with gifts and character, particular traits. And how is it that often, I'm not trying to say that there's a direct correlation here, but it seems like there's enough of a correspondence. How is it that so often the charismatic folks are the ones who are very much wrapped up in their own involvement in something? I don't want to say that they're always controlling, but there often is a kind of controlling pattern because they are so involved in seeing that it happens, and that's part of their gift of helping to make it happen. But it's kind of hard to sometimes step back and allow the gifts of others to really take hold as well. So it's a tangent, but it's an interesting tangent where, you know, charisma is good, but often the charismatic leader somehow loses sight of that fine line of their gifts versus celebrating and inviting in the gifts of others. And just a kind of a thought.
Or if you don't have the same gift that we do, then you're not quite good.
Right. A hierarchy of gifts. Treating people differently. That's, I think, a mistake in ministry. Now, that's not to say that we don't inevitably have to treat people according to what's appropriate. But what I'm saying is, this is a struggle for me. In our congregation, we have literally the full gamut of intellectual capacity and functioning. And for me to, I really try and do this as well as I can, but to honor whoever that person is in my conversation with them. And that's a real challenge at times, because it literally might take me 10 minutes to have, you know, significant conversation with somebody who's at a very low functional level, and I might have only 30 seconds of conversation with somebody else, and we've already, you know, gone way past where we went with this other person in 10 minutes. And it's not about efficiency, it's about how do I stay engaged with wherever that person is. And, I enjoy the challenge, but there are times when I'm not feeling so rested, or I'm feeling distracted because of something else, where I don't feel like I can be as present. And I find it more difficult to be present with people who take 15 minutes to say 5 minutes of stuff. And typically it's the lower functioning folks who fall into that, and so that's something that I have to be aware of and pay attention to, and not treat them differently, as in spend less present energy with them. And it's not about the time, not metering the time, it's just about my attitude of presence with them, and I just have to kind of gear into dealing with them. And, you know, that's just one extreme. Then there's the sort of emotional, affirmational extreme, where you have the whiners and complainers, who that's kind of like their 90% of their mode is that, and once in a while they'll kind of come out of that and say something positive about themselves or about somebody else. And then you have the other folks at the other end who are like, it's always good, it's always good, and they are very seldom to, you know, call it like they really see it and really name it as something that's not so good. And how do we try and treat people at both ends of the spectrum, as well as all along, with grace and honor and respect? Because how many of you enjoy going to the whiners and complainers all the time? But yet, they're a part of the congregation too, and you've got to hear them out. So, you know, in chaplaincy, you've got those patients who are just real troopers, and you've got those that are extremely needy, and it's, you know, how do you, or you've got the clients who are real risk averse, and how do you try and help them to come to terms with how they can manage things?
I think one of the key points of really communicate with them without misunderstanding is try to understand them first. And try to understand their needs, what they really need, instead of what topic I'm going to bring up in order to talk with him or spend some time with him. I think the first thing is people would like to feel that they are cared for rather than they are just one of the people they want to talk to.
Yeah.
And I also think once you put your heart into the conversation, what way to communicate is not an issue anymore. Maybe this client is very talkative, but he wants to spend 30 minutes with me talking about his dogs. On the other hand, I have five phone lines, you know, five phone calls on the line, but I would say, you know, in a polite way, maybe I can call you some other time, maybe after market close or something. So I think the key point is people like to be cared.
Mm-hmm. That's very good.
I'm not sure how this really still working. One of the points you bring there is one of the things that I struggle with personally, because patients, and I'm sure, well, just exactly what you're saying with the parishioners, some, you know, you've got certain ones that remind you of yourself. My practice is, it's a university practice, and so we have people that seek out university care and other people that, you know, the poor and destitute in our community come to us too. And, you know, I feel the obligation to give each of them the same understanding of their cancer and their prognosis and all the things that go into cancer care. But some people just, you know, they come in and it's, you know, hi, how are you? How are your kids? I heard you're going on a trip, and we go through all the sort of social activity. And other people come in, you know, they haven't eaten for a couple of days, and it's, they don't, you know, they're at me. And this is something, and I don't know how you deal with that too, but it's something that it's really hard for me sometimes to go home and realize, I didn't help this person the way I wanted to today. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those are real struggles for me. I go to a lot of funerals and visitations and things for my patients when they die. I've gone to very few in our inner city.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at that, and that to me is one of these measurement outcomes, mistakes that I make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it's not a mistake in the classic sense, but I feel like I'm not doing something that I really need to be doing for people in that way, or at least to maybe I'm trying to feed my own problem, but just, it's so easy to work with people and to, you know, like you're saying, to communicate with people that maybe that remind yourself. But if you get back to the office and you've got 15 messages from the same person who wants to put two shares of IBM here and one share, you know.
They're changing the IBM price every 2 minutes.
Right, and that, you know, and they're on it. You've got three things sitting on your desk when you come in the morning. For me, it's, you know, I've got a dozen clients or patients that leave me messages. They're going to run out of their narcotics, and it's Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock. And, you know, they go, oh, jeez. So I'm sitting there calling pharmacies and writing prescriptions, and it's, and others will suffer with pain through the weekend because they don't want to bother you.
Right.
And both of them have needs, and I don't address their needs equally. Mm-hmm. So I'm failing them both in some sense. And so those are the kinds of things that the mistakes of how you deal with your professional or personal life. You start, and I guess this is a long way of coming back to saying, if you don't keep your eyes open, like you were saying, Sonny, just thinking, and if you're not constantly measuring your mistakes and figuring out what you need in order to improve those relationships and things, it's as though you start a cut on a board. You've got the guide, you've got the table saw, and you close your eyes. And you can't do that. I mean, sure, you've got everything lined up just right, and theoretically it's supposed to go through, but you can't. And that's the way I feel like a lot of parts of my mm-hmm. practice is you have to keep your eyes open all the time and increase your level of awareness on a lot of different levels.
Automatic pilot just leads us astray
right.
too easily.
I'm still nervous when I see the pilots walk through the cabin, too.
So we talked about, or we alluded to this earlier, with the come clean, not up front with our real motives in terms of what it is that we are, for ourselves, trying to accomplish, or maybe in terms of what we're communicating to those that we're working with of what we're trying to accomplish. And I guess to the extent that what our real motives are is knowable, it seems like the more we can communicate what we're really about, I think it helps put people at ease, it helps people be trustful, and I think it helps us to be trustful of others because we can help model that sense of transparency, and I mean that in the good sense, of being upfront with what we're really about. Now this is me speaking as not true confessions, but as things that I've learned about as a pastor. And if I'm doing something that seems a little questionable to myself or potentially questionable to others, I will acknowledge that in the midst of the conversation with somebody. And I've often found that that gives permission to others to raise their doubts about the wisdom of whatever it is that we're talking about. I've also found that sometimes it gives people collective permission to say, we recognize that, but we're going to proceed anyway because our gut tells us that this is the right way to go, even though it looks like it might be a little less than totally problem-free or ethical or anything of that sort. Because sometimes the ethical thing isn't always the most effective pastoral thing in some situations. And I'm scratching my head trying to come up with an example right now. I'm sure there are situations in chaplaincy where that's come up. Maybe somebody has a meal request days before their death that is not typically honored in the setting that you're in, but that seems like the right thing to do, and maybe it's something that gets catered in from outside, which is against policies and procedures, I don't know. But, the whole question of how we be accountable to ourselves and to others about what we're really about.
Well, there's an honesty about what you said. You know, you're putting it out there. I mean, with probably more true years back that we put ministers on this pedestal or doctors on this pedestal or whatever, or chaplains or whatever. And by saying, I'm not sure this is right, you know, we're showing that, you know, we struggle with this too. And we're allowing them to know that, you know, do we need to change this? I'd like your input. And it gives us more, we've talked about communication. It just mm-hmm. opens the doors of yep. communication and yep. takes us off pedestals.
And not to pick on folks in a different generation from my own, but I think you put your finger on something that previous generations haven't had that permission, maybe, mm-hmm. to work in that way. So that if there was doubt, it was never expressed, or very, very quietly expressed in back corners rather than out front. And I think that's part about what's going on in our current situation is a paradigm shift of, one might call it, has etymological roots in that it's, I'm sorry, epistemological roots in the sense of how do we know what we know and what is knowledge really? Is it, you know, this factual, incontrovertible kinds of things, or is it something that's experiential, that has a resonance with a number of us, and, you know, the whole scholarly debates over, you know, Western understanding of history and culture versus a more inclusive continental African understanding of history and culture, and, you know, how many different perspectives do we bring to what's really significant in our understanding of meaning and so forth. And that could be a whole nother lifetime of research wandering through that, but it's, I really think that there is a kind of significant paradigm shift going on with how many voices do we recognize as having authority in the conversation. And in the past, it was relatively fewer voices. And in some circles, that's still the way it is. But it seems like more and more, and, you know, just look at industry. Who would imagine from back in the 1950s and 60s mentality that you would ever see a day where the assembly worker on the line and one of the middle managers, along with the foreman, along with the vice president back in the central administrative office, would ever come together around a table to discuss a problem in the line? You know, that was just unthinkable. You got your orders, here's the procedure, the engineers have worked it out, the line's running, get the job, and go to your post and get to it. End of discussion. And now we recognize that things are changing fast enough that maybe the guy on the line, seeing, you know, the 500th spot weld that's a problem because something was misprogrammed in the robotic, or because maybe there was a better way to hang the car on the line so that it would take an hour less in the overall sum total of human hours working on that particular step. Maybe the guy on the line really does know something because he's the one that's right there in the middle of the problem and can see something that can be changed for the better. So the whole idea of who all has voice and authority into the discussions about what changes are needing to be brought about. Other sources of mistakes in our work. We're overly anxious. And that obviously, I'm not saying that we can't be anxious in appropriate ways, but I'm talking about when we're overly anxious, that we end up sort of tripping on our own feet and get too wrought. Or we have poor follow-through. You know, we say we're going to do something, or we say we're going to see that somebody else follows up with this, and then we've dropped the ball. Unclear goals or standards or vision, and we alluded to that a little bit earlier, talking about thinking and wrong address and inadequate resources, considering count and costs, considering or counting the costs, being clear on what it is that we're about. Wrong people for the job, we talked about that, and too much pressure, not enough time. And that's probably something that a lot of folks can relate to these days. Efficiency, 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 and there's the pressure of producing. And I know even in the medical setting, I was a patient advocate back during seminary as a part-time job, and utilization review was such a...
Utilization of what?
Utilization review is the team within the hospital that takes the financial kind of constraints and budget and so forth and takes the DRGs, the diagnostic related groups, and is trying to, in its best, micromanage the patient care that's given and say that, you know, according to DRGs, this should only be such and such number of days of treatment and so forth. And some doctors might say, oh, the person can stay in for two or three more days because they've got this, this, and this going on. So this whole process meant that physicians had to be accountable to the system for why they thought that person should stay in another two or three days, rather than just being able to make the decision and letting administration deal with the aftermath of the accounting and the financial considerations. There was this extra step that would say, wait a minute, you know, justify your reason for, your rationale for, more than the typical three-day stay. And it was also to try and keep the costs underneath the Medicare guidelines so that the hospital could at least try and break even along those lines, if not come in under. And so It's kind of like in the hospital, what's been going on in the Blue Cross Blue Shield private insurers versus the HMOs, where there's this financial management piece that gets inserted, so that it's not just about the health treatment of the patient, but it's also about the financial implications of decisions that are made along the way. How many extra tests are ordered? Can you justify calling for those tests? How much is being spent on this person's care? And if it's private insurance, you have to answer to the insurers of whether they'll cover all that. If it's Medicare, you have to answer to them if whether they'll cover it all. And that's why these guidelines became very significant. And my point about all that is that it's meant more pressure for nursing and physicians and so forth to quote unquote justify everything that they're doing every step of the way. And it's made patients feel like they are not assured of always getting medical over financial kinds of care, if you know what I'm trying to say. It's like it's being, it at least raises the question, is my medical care hinging on financial consideration? Then is my medical care kind of coming first and foremost, and the financial considerations will be dealt with secondarily? And I think that it's a necessary evolutionary step in our medical care system because of the cost getting so, you know, higher and higher, but it's also raised the doubt in people's minds as to, is my medical care first and foremost, or is my financial picture somehow bollocked up inside of all that? So too much pressure, not enough time. That's where all that's going, is just that it's made for a lot of anxious healthcare professionals in having to try and meet all these simultaneous demands of good patient care and treatment, along with all this financial accountability at the same time. And at least in the hospital setting I was working in, utilization review was kind of like this group, Rambo team that could descend on any ward of the hospital at any time and ask to see files at any moment's notice, and basically walked around with this huge club, and they could have a patient dismissed within 3 hours if they could warrant that. And I just marveled at that. And then to try and be a patient advocate in the middle of all that, you know, patient advocate's a peon just a barely above an orderly or a nurse's aide, at least at that point. And so it was a really interesting challenge.
It's not as bad.
I hope it's gotten better. This was in its earlier stages back about 15, 16 years ago. So
a lot of that stuff didn't work, so they stopped doing it. It was very adversarial.
Yes, it was. You're right. So now I want to talk a little bit more about this handbook, because that's, in a sense, what we hopefully were looking for in the first place, is how do we deal with mistakes in our work? And we've already talked about a few. Coming clean and using that as a way back at prevention, understanding, and we talked about good communication. And classically, we might talk about things like acknowledgement, confession, repentance, forgiveness, reconciliation / recompense. Maybe there's some way of addressing grievances in an appropriate way. And ultimately, as people of faith, we want to talk about redemption, in that we are simultaneously justus et peccator, at the same time sanctified, made holy, and at the same time we are clearly falling short of the mark. We are saint and sinner. And you know, we each have to come to terms with how do we understand that theology in our working lives. Are we, you know, 90% saint and only 10% sinner, or 10% saint and 90% sinner? Or do we not look at it as some kind of a spectrum, but see it as a kind of quality of attention where we are, despite our best intentions to do the right thing and to do the quality true thing, we will fall short of the mark. We will miscommunicate. We will misunderstand. We will push too hard. We will miss a piece of information that, had we known it, would have helped us stay on track with the situation or the decisions that were being made. Had we been a little bit more rested and not stressed out from the previous 3 months of hard push, we might have been a little bit more alert for that nuance that came along. We might have been more willing to catch up on our messages rather than let them float another few hours or a few days. And maybe something that was actually quite urgent missed our attention because we were kind of dealing with the messages in a very, you know, unimportant way. Redemption says that despite it all, we are still beloved children of God. We are still ministers. We are still part of the priesthood of all believers. We still are called by name to the work that we are given to do. And so it's not an all or nothing proposition in that you either got to do it all the time correctly or you're out of there. And we know that there are some situations like that. But that, how do we deal with the falling short of the mark and move on and learn from that? Thoughts or comments that come to mind?
Professional level, I mean, you either have, there's two parts of this, I think. One is you have to figure out a personal way of dealing with the inevitable.
Personal conscience.
And also cope. You know, you have to cope with that. You know, the unthinkable happens with something that you can tie to something that you did. I mean, how do you deal with that and go on? And the other handling part is also, maybe this is a different issue, but it's a totally different issue, but if you have a colleague that's incompetent, chaplain that starts every conversation with the, I've got a cold today too, and I feel so bad. I feel like I'm going to die. Wait a minute. That's what you're here for. So sometimes it comes out of the safety of society issues and someone looks at them.
Right.
The person who insists on jump on. Heavy on jump on corporate. So those are two completely different things. I personally have the personal being able to tolerate the ambiguity that comes in life and figure out ways to understand that like your progressive targeting model that you gave, even if you don't always hit the mark, you've got a way to learn and correct, and hopefully the next person benefits from it. We talked about this a couple of days ago, Bill. You gotta bust a few boards before you get the perfect piece of equipment, and hopefully don't.
Yep.
Depending on your particular career, you don't bust too many of whatever you're working with before.
Right. How many trial and error case situations with patients or clients or orders do we have to go through before we quote unquote get it right most of the time? There's a learning curve that we all have.
How many rockets were blown up before they finally put them on the space station?
Right. Michael, you were about to jump in there.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the difficulties in handling, and maybe this is where the woodworking analogy or something might break down, or maybe it's just because I know nothing about woodworking and that stuff. But one of the issues, at least in dealing with other people, and here this notion of ambiguity, I would think about contingency. Mm-hmm. And I thought when your example, if I would have had enough, rest or something, I could have handled this better. And, sometimes that might, maybe in woodwork, you can plan and get the right materials and all of that, and then, but sometimes the contingencies come up that, you're in a situation to say, yes, if only one patient a week will die, I can handle it, but what do you do on that day? The contingency is such that five people die. And, unfortunately, they're not willing to adjust your schedule to, or their schedule of dying to your day timer. And so, I mean, you know, boom, you're hit with that, whether you're awake or asleep, energized, not ready for it, and it's there, right? Now that kind of sense of how do you handle it? And I think there's more to it than coping. I mean, you know, we say the way we go through that is kind of a coping mechanism. But I'm not so sure, right offhand, that merely coping is what we have to quote unquote, you know, handle contingency. There's something else that's there.
I want to try this out in response to that, Michael, and others of you might have thoughts too. This is a totally different analogy here, but you'll probably see where I'm going with this. A car has a certain amount of horsepower for acceleration, for carrying different loads, and for the weight of the vehicle itself. So for example, a small Pinto, if we can use that old example, never really needed an 8-cylinder engine in it, at least not an 8-cylinder as we typically have it with, you know, nearly 200 horsepower or so and the weight of it and so forth. And yet, they had to come up with a 4-cylinder engine that they came up with for that, that had enough horsepower plus. In other words, it's not considered safe for a boat or a car or a truck to be working with 100% of its ability 100% of the time. So that as you're cruising down the highway, if you need to accelerate a little bit to avoid something, or if you've got wind conditions that are buffeting the car, you need to have a little bit more power to be able to stay on track with that. Or you've got snow conditions where you're slogging through a lot of stuff that you've got to drive through that takes more power. A boat, you know, the wave action or the something about the temperature conditions of the water or something that affects the way the boat handles. Airplanes, you've always got to have more than enough power for the weight, and you know, suppose you lose an engine, now you're down to 3 out of 4 or 1 out of 2 engines. My point being that maybe one way of dealing with contingencies is rather than our thinking that we can work 60-hour work weeks and be at our peak condition, maybe we have to say, you know, there are going to be some weeks that are going to be 70 hours, and I'm going to need that extra reserve, so maybe I'm better off working 50 hours a week most of the time, at about 85% of my capacity or 90% of my capacity, rather than pushing at full throttle all the time, thinking that I can then just reach into my reserves and pull out another 10% to go for 110% and be flat out broke, and then some. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that maybe some of our handling and coping is actually prevention of our own burnout by pacing ourselves. And we talked a little bit about this the other day. And that maybe by better pacing ourselves, we would have fewer mistakes to begin with. Or when they do come, we'd be better equipped how to deal with those mistakes. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that maybe we are more fragile human beings as whole systems than we sometimes allow ourselves to live as. You know, we have this sense of invincibility or always being able to reach for one more tool that can just kind of get us over the hump in terms of efficiency, and whether it's the date timer or the cell phone or the fax machine or the laptop or whatever. And maybe we just, instead of saying, oh, now this allows me to do things this much more quickly, this much more full out, we just say, okay, and this is kind of back to what you said, considering the count and counting the costs. So now I've got a laptop. So how can I, you know, incorporate this into my tools, and what benefits does it bring, but also what costs does it bring, and what can I shave away or pull back from? And to actually do that, rather than just to say, oh, this will allow me a little bit more leisure time, to actually help that pulling back process get realized. Other thoughts? Michael?
Let me come back to that. Answer my own question here. I agree. I think your way of saying, okay, you calculate that and you're back in the sense of prevention. I guess another way I'd look at that is to say perhaps one way we need to think about handling this is to recognize more, I guess where I'm getting this one from, we're working more in community. That sometimes, I mean, so far, the way we've been looking at this is basically, okay, how do I handle my mistakes? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think we might have to look at this about how do we handle my mistakes? Mm-hmm. And part of that starts out with coming clean. Here's where I think perhaps the woodworking analogy, you know, I'm trying to make it bookcase or whatever, and if you will, I'm going there, and all of a sudden, uh-oh, and I've made a mistake, and now what am I going to do? Well, maybe the way I handle my mistake is I go to Bill, and I go to, you know, the local woodworkers club that meets once a month, and to say, well, you know, I'm making this shelf, and I'm doing this, and the joints aren't quite even.
Yeah.
What do I do? Well, I have all this expertise here to help me. I think, you know, part of that, now the only, you know, in terms of what we put on there, the real difficulty on that one is, well, what happens if you have incompetent colleagues? But you know, let's hope, right? Let's hope that, again, in a sense of community, which indeed there might be some incompetent folks in, but there are others who are, and I think that, you know, I think experientially too, I would say, you know, how do you deal with contingencies when you feel overwhelmed? You know, part of that is, as well as trying to prepare for that, part of that is recognizing maybe, well, you know, there has to be more than just me to get through it.
Absolutely.
We have a sense of community. And I mean, at least certainly within the Christian sense of that. I mean, right? We have communities of faith to help us through, or, you know, even our family can be that community. And without that, I think there's a lot of things that, quite frankly, you just can't handle on your own.
I'd like to piggyback on what you said. When we have our befrienders leave the hospital after they've made their lay people who make calls on patients, they have to write up their visits, and they have to debrief with a chaplain. They have to talk to a chaplain about the visits they've made, so that they don't carry all of this burden home with them. That's all, we can get referrals. But I think about a physician who, on a daily basis, is, you know, there are patients dying, and there are patients, you know, all sorts of things, and all of us. And so often, who does the? I'm gonna pick on you right here. What's your first name?
Bruce.
Bruce. Okay. What does Bruce do? You don't want to go to a colleague, because, you know, sometimes that's a harder thing to do. So who does Bruce go to say, I need 15 minutes of somebody's time to just talk about, so I don't have to carry it home to my wife. I don't have to carry it home to my children. I don't have to keep it rattling around in my head. Do we each have somebody that we can go to debrief? As a chaplain, you know, I go to my other colleague that's in the hospital and say, I just had a rotten day, and I'm going to close the door and tell you about it, because I don't know what else to do with it. And I think perhaps, and this may not be true, but the higher people go up in the professional scale, and the more education we've had, we somehow think that we can't go to our colleagues or to somebody else to debrief who we are. The patient can tell you what's happening in their lives and all sorts of things, but the colleague, I have only two physicians that come to my office on whenever they sort of need to just kind of close the door and talk about what they're going through. I wonder, and as a chaplain, when I got my training, my boss said, just know that you need to talk to the ministers who come through the door, because who debriefs the minister? Who ministers to the minister? Who do they go to? And know that, just say to them, how you doing? And it'll be amazing what they will pour out in needing somebody outside their congregation to just talk about what's going on in their lives. So I think, you know, whoever we choose, we've got to have somebody that can be that person to share our pain with, our mistakes, our stress, and we know what stress can do to us. We get sick.
I'm calling that a listening coach, and that actually can fit into both of these, because there are times where you just need to debrief where you've blown it, but there are other times where, in the debriefing, that helps you stay away from that. but it's not just an individual thing. I like your comment, Michael, about seeing this as a community thing, that it's our being accountable with each other and recognizing that at some point we all feel inadequate to the task, or we all fall short of the mark. And where do we minister, not just alongside of or with each other, but to each other, in acknowledging those times of less than stellar performance, or maybe collectively somehow we've dropped the ball.
Yeah. I mean, at a university, you'd call that collegiality, and usually among the faculty, there's very little collegiality because, right, you're all supposed to be experts, you're all supposed to know it all in your field, yep. And of course, the last thing you would ever do is talk to a colleague to say, well, you know, I blew it, I don't get it, I made a mistake, because that is, quote unquote, admitting failure, which of course I, as the expert prima donna in my field, never have.
Right.
So, I mean, there's...
That's why usually colleagues can't do that for each other.
Yeah. Maybe we should just, these other verses are kind of fun to look at. And James 3, because we need to end our time here.
Yeah.
We've been very patient, and we actually started a little bit late, but that's okay. This word in James 3 comes from taio, making a mistake, which has a sense of stumbling or falling or failing. And I guess it's interesting, you know, it's not like we intend to make mistakes. We're basically on a good path. And sometimes we stumble, we fall in the midst of a good path. And sometimes that's what we would maybe call the, not necessarily the sin of commission, where we're committing a sin, but the sin of omission, where we just didn't watch that little stumbling block that came along, and we omitted to avoid that, or to get around it. Colossians 1, 11 through 14, and then 1 John is a good note to end on, I think. Colossians 1, 11 through 14. May you be made strong with all the strength that comes from his glorious power, and may you be prepared to endure everything with patience while joyfully giving thanks to the Father who has enabled you to share in the inheritance of the saints in the light. He has rescued us from the power of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Recognizing that we are a part of this redeemed community, and that we try as we will fall short of the mark, but that we are still part of this redeemed community. And then finally, 1 John, verse 6. If we say that we have fellowship with him while we are walking in darkness, we lie and do not do what is true. But if we walk in the light, as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. And of course, you've heard this from the LBW, this next part. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, one who is faithful and just will forgive our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If we say that we have not sinned, we make him a liar, and his word is not in us. My little children, I am writing these things to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous, and he is the atoning sacrifice for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the sins of the whole world. So, I don't know about you, but for me, in times where I have blown it in the congregation, and I've acknowledged that in front of the congregation, and believe me, that's very difficult as a pastor to publicly acknowledge things where you've made an error of judgment. The congregation I'm serving has always come back with forgiveness, and I can't speak for other situations with other congregations, but for me, I've learned to trust that if we really acknowledge in faith and repent in faith, that people will forgive in faith, and ultimately that's what we're assured of, even as we look at the scriptures and hear the good news. Thank you very much. I hope this was fun to kind of think analogously.
Thank you.
Okay.
I have to run off because I'm running out of time as a visitor. I hear you want to do it.
Or Mike.
Genial.